So, Katie, you're taking the middle road down a little bit low, which makes a lot of sense. But I want to pause for a moment before we even talk about the route out in detail and go to the route back. This pilot has already made the assumption they're going to fly back direct with the tailwinds, and they're trying to figure out how to have the most fuel available for that. Flying out direct with the headwinds is not an option for you. Is flying back with the tailwinds an option for you?
Well, it's an option for the pilot in this scenario, and it may be tempting, but personally, I wouldn't fly direct back over the mountains in a single-engine airplane close to nighttime with a passenger. That wouldn't be my choice. I'd stop for fuel before I made that direct flight.
Even with a strong tailwind limiting that exposure time that you have.
Even with a strong tailwind, assuming I'm still having high winds aloft, and the potential for turbulence. And for me, the biggest concern is single engine over the mountains close to nighttime.
Just a non-starter.
It is a non-starter for me.
I'm curious if there's anyone around the table who, before we go on to the route out on that route back, would take that direct route back, which is kind of for the setup for this whole thing.
Yes, but not in this airplane. Maybe a bigger single where you could carry more survival gear. I think to me, that's what turns on this. Is how much gear I can carry to survive in those circumstances. Because every year, dozens of people go out in the mountains or the wilderness. They don't have their survival gear. They have a problem, and they don't do well if they survive at all. So something, I don't know, like a Saratoga or something that could carry a bunch of stuff.
Out west, flying also you have to take into consideration is radar coverage over the mountains is really spotty. So I have a feeling, I'm not for sure, but I have a feeling in this area you're probably not on radar as well. So that adds a lot of danger.
Yeah, I agree with Katie's choice on the way out. That seems like a pretty slam dunk. That just seems like the right thing to do. But boy, does it set up a character test on the way back. I'm looking at this situation, you know, a 50-knot tailwind, avoiding a fuel stop. That is so tempting, but it's like the right thing to do, as Katie said, you know, right before nightfall, springtime in the mountains at high elevations, you got to avoid that. And I'll disagree with my friend Paul. It's like, I don't care what how much survival gear you've got. Those are some steep, jagged mountains. And I'd have no confidence of surviving the impact of a forced landing there at all.
You know, if I was really doing this flight, I would probably shorten my hike and give myself time to make a fuel stop either in the front end or the back end of the trip. From a practical and safe standpoint, that really is the best choice, I think.
Yeah, I keep hearing fuel in this scenario. And to me, the best choice would be on your way out, stop and get some fuel. You've already built in that delay. And now you know whenever you arrive in the park, okay, we've got X many hours, and whatever route you choose, I need to leave by such and such a time, and I've got enough fuel to get there with a comfortable margin.
I am surprised, though, Katie, that you chose the 8,500 because I am so tempted to do the 12,500 because when I've flown in Montana and that mountain, you know, you're flying and then the air just tumbles over those mountains and you flying below in the valley, I can just see that creating a lot of issues versus just getting up above all that stuff. So I would be tempted to do the 12,500 even with the strong winds.
And part of the consideration for not only the lower terrain, but also part of the consideration for the less than direct route into the park in the first place is the potential for mountain wave turbulence. That potential hasn't gone away on the return trip in a direct route. You're exposing yourself and your passenger directly to that as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're going to be dealing with that one way or the other. So let's go a little bit more. I'd like to dig into that route out and, okay, let's evaluate that middle road. We've got some discrepancy at the table here about what altitude you try for. How do you evaluate that, especially if you're not a pilot who grew up dealing with winds over terrain? Because it doesn't take a lot of terrain to create at least mechanical turbulence and even some wave. How do you evaluate that?
Well, you know, the surface winds are light, and you're in a Super Cub. Frankly, don't think I would get up to 8,500 until I absolutely had to. Super Cubs fly great down low, and you're going to sightsee, and you've got this passenger, and you're trying to find some smooth air for them. It's like, personally, about 1,000 AGL up the valley, then climb, deal with the turbulence for a short period, crossing, and come in and land. And I think you're going to arrive there with the most fuel doing it that way.
Well, now I'm going to challenge that for a moment. If you did run into a wave situation or some significant downdrafts, 1,000 feet above terrain doesn't seem to me like a lot if you suddenly run into a 900 or 1,000 foot per minute downward wave that you weren't expecting. You don't got a lot of clearance over that terrain.
Right, which is why 8,500, I think, is a pretty good option because, you know, Gardner is at about 5,300 feet in elevation, and that gives you just over 3,000 feet between your airplane and Gardner or the valley below, which in my opinion is plenty of time to make a correction or pick a good place to land.
So what are some other telltales, like, as you're moving through the mountains? I mean, you have some mountain flying experience, and you have some other around the table. What do you look for? What are the hints that you might come across that help you stay out of trouble as you're, you know, tooling down that valley at 8,500 feet? What are you looking for in the airplane? What are you listening for? What are you feeling? What are you...
Lenticular clouds are the obvious giveaway. Even other things. You know, I mean, you can see the if it's cloudy, you can see the speed and direction of the cloud shadows over the terrain. You know, you can, if your Super Cub's unlikely to have it, but if you're going to have something that shows wind speed and direction. And also, you know, glider pilots are great. They can visualize how the air is tumbling into the valley, or where the upslope air is gonna provide lift and ridge lift. And you know, it's a dynamic situation, but it's predictable.
Are there any other techniques that people have come across? I'll make a call out here to our proofer who goes through all these scenarios beforehand. One of her mountain flying, mentors actually told her to set the heading bug on the direction that the winds are coming from as you're weaving your way down a valley for a constant change of where the winds aloft are. I thought that was very clever. I'd never heard that one before, and that was from someone in Idaho. I'm curious if there are any other just airplane flying techniques. You mentioned approaching the ridges at a 45-degree angle. I learned to fly in Colorado, and that was the way every time we flew, you know, from the Boulder area to the west. We had to nurse planes up over each one of these passes with only 160 horse. Every single one we would cross at, you know, 45-degree angle on approach. Any other tidbits and things like that, people's experience?
Well, especially in this area, and if you look at the terrain, the ridges, it's not like the East Coast where the ridges all run north-south and essentially in the same direction. They're all over the place out here in the West, especially over Yellowstone Park. So I think it's important to remember that if you pick something and it works for 10 or 20 miles, it may not work in the next 10 or 20 miles. You know, your altitude might not work. The way that you're approaching the ridge may not be best determined or based on what you're feeling and what the airplane is experiencing. And that's okay. Go find and search for the best experience and the best ride that you possibly can and for the most safety. But it may not be one choice. You may have to do multiple things on flight.
I think it's also important to remember the turbulence penetration speed. I'm not super familiar with the Cubs. I don't know if they have a speed like that, but certainly the King Air does. So you're going to be slowing down if you do penetrate that turbulence.
You know, and a question for Katie, it's like, all right, you mentioned car gas and the STC and your alternatives. What if the airplane doesn't have an STC for car gas? Would you consider putting car gas in just based on the fact that the STC is straight paperwork?
You know, this is not my airplane, so I wouldn't consider putting car gas into an airplane that was somebody else's.
But your responsibility is to bring it back in one piece. If putting car gas in it would help that objective, you wouldn't even consider?
There's other airports in the area, and I think I would need to plan better and plan and give myself enough time to stop at a different airport, whether it's Gardner or Ennis or go back up to Bozeman. But if it wasn't my airplane and didn't have an STC for it, I would make provisions for landing somewhere else first.
And you mentioned like a shorter time at the park. It's easy to say, it's hard to do. How many times do we plan these outings and you're running late? And it's like this whole scenario is just a setup for some really tough choices on the way home.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same thing. Instead of planning a shorter time at the park, I'd say let's plan a longer time at the park, take some camping gear and camp by the airplane overnight, fly back the next morning.
Yeah, that can be, I mean, you know, one of the best techniques for yourself to avoid that risk window is just make the day end after that first flight. If there's any way to make that possible, it just removes that whole scenario.
I'm thinking also the scenario pilot has limited mountain flying experience and is trying to introduce a friend to the wonder of flying in the Yellowstone area. Is this possibly not the best day to be doing it? Look at the conditions here. There are some pretty significant winds. Now, I've flown in southern Colorado. The winds come and go. I don't know the Yellowstone area. Maybe there just isn't a better time in the Yellowstone area. But part of the issue here revolves around the pilot's decision to make this trip in the first place under these conditions. Maybe first time up with a passenger with only 3 hours of mountain time, you want to wait for some better conditions.
Or one other option is maybe you don't have enough room or you don't want to carry gear to camp overnight, is just plan on the way back to head back toward Bozeman and land at one of those airports and stay in a motel that night and then make the rest of the trip in the calm of the morning.
Right. Sure. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the concept of risk exposure and what you're willing to do and not willing to do. You know, when we talk about that trip home, right, it is over some nasty terrain. And if an engine were to fail, it's you're spending a night that's probably survivable, but not going to be a pleasant evening at all. But it is a short window. How do you decide, you know, how much of that you're willing to accept? Because there are even other flights that you might be doing just between airports, not over a mountain. But if you go down, the chances of someone getting to you, even if your ELT goes off, your PLB goes off, they may not get to you until the next day.
It's a question of probabilities. So if you look at the time of exposure relative to the whole length of the flight, maybe the exposure that's unacceptable where you're over that high terrain and you don't have a place to glide, maybe it's 10 minutes out of an hour and 10 minutes. Okay, is that acceptable? For some people, it will be. For others, it won't be. But, you know, all kinds of flying, you have windows of exposure. You don't have an option. And you're taking a risk. Has to do with takeoff over trees or into weather, all sorts of things. So to me, it's a question of, do I have a situation where I can always do this or I can go to B or C? And how long is the period where I got nothing?
Well, yeah, the exact opposite of terrain issues is where I live, Wichita, Kansas. And if I'm flying a very typical flight for me, which is from an airport on the east side to the commercial airport on the west side to pick someone up or to take it to the shop or something, I have a period of time where I'm flying over downtown Wichita. I've got a short period of exposure where there are very limited options. So every time you fly an airplane, there are going to be those periods. You have to decide, is it really worth flying all the way around the city? Or do I fly over that? Is it really worth flying all of the way around the mountains, or do I fly directly over it? In this particular case, I like flying around the mountains because there are significant options available that are not that very far out of the way. But as Paul said, there's risk in every flight. You have to decide what you're comfortable with.
There's risk and there's reward. And so it's like, what's the risk? What's the reward? In this one, it's like, you know, the risk is I'm going to die from hypothermia on a cold mountain peak. The reward is I've shortened my trip by about 20 minutes. Seems like the risk reward option here is pretty skewed in one direction.
Yeah, but you run into that on all kinds of flights. I flew around New England a lot and in IFR conditions with students, and we'd be flying approaches like into Groton or into Islip, where ATC brings you down low for an intercept, you're in a single. If you lose the engine, you're gone in the water, and it could be in the winter. Well, there's a risk-reward there, too. What's the reward? Well, you're getting the real weather experience and the training. The risk is you could freeze to death.
Groton, Connecticut's a long way from Yellowstone National Park. I don't see the relevance.
Well, I don't know why, if you're flying in a Cub, you're really concerned about getting anywhere quickly. Anyway, why are you trying to save 20 minutes? Like, you're flying in the most beautiful part of the country. Take your time. Well, I wouldn't go direct.
If I could make a pitch for going to Montana, I'd say land in Livingston on the way home and spend the night at Chico Hot Springs.
Well, that may be a takeaway from this whole thing here. You know, it would be more than 20 minutes. We're talking about changing the flight by 80 nautical miles via the longest route versus the shortest route, which is kind of an eternity even in a Super Cub or in a Super Cub. But nonetheless, you're trying to weigh these different options about what you want to do for this experience in the park. And part of it is the experience, if you're taking a Super Cub, of getting to the park, you know, flying down Paradise Valley one way or another, where you do have this, you know, beautiful scenery around you. And if you decide that, hey, on the flight home, it's gotten too rough or it's getting too late, you know, you do have the camping gear in the airplane, or at least enough gear potentially to stop and land, not forced landing somewhere, and have at least a comfortable evening, even if unplanned, somewhere else. So, you know, maybe that's a part of the thinking. You want to have a experience flying in the mountains. You want to have a plan for it. But if you're going into that kind of terrain, partly you're doing it for the experience of the mountain flight itself. And you shouldn't be too focused on getting to a particular destination, because you might need more flexibility on how to get there.